Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is October the 16th, 2019. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m., the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message if you have any questions or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. In the headlines, WeWork failed IPO and its impact on Meetup.com. Microsoft Word users are unhappy with Apple's new Catalina operating system. Google announces new hardware. The iPhone 11 series is not scratch resistant. Multiple problems reported with new Windows 10 updates. Now Microsoft is taking control over your personal computer. The latest in TV subscription deals. In our feature segment by Benjamin Rockwell, IT Pro Series, BYOD Bring Your Own Devices to Work, Part 3 of 3. From the Tech Corner, what is Libra cryptocurrency and Calibra wallet? Feature segment with Marty Winston on Technology Perspectives, Trick or Treating with Tech. WeWork failed IPO and its impact on Meetup.com. WeWork stands before us in all its naked glory. WeWork was founded in 2010 by Adam Neumann, its co-founder and chief executive officer in the Soho district of New York City, to provide co-working space primarily for freelancers and small startups. In the 9 years since its founding, the company has grown rapidly and consists of 528 locations in 111 cities and 29 countries. WeWork has copied an old business model, that is to say, office leasing. They assign some tech lingo describing the company and valuing the company at more than 10 times its nearest competitor. The company has burned through tons of cash and lack acceptable corporate governance practices. Neumann's grip on the company is equally troubling, as he still controls most of the voting rights after the listing. That gives him the power to remove directors and executives who displease him and, of course, to dictate strategy. It's an unequal relationship, too. Despite his apparent importance, he doesn't have an employment contract, meaning he could leave at any time in theory. While WeWork is growing rapidly, the service it offers is not new. WeWork described its business model in the full tech lingo of Space as a Service, that's SaaS, and its mission as elevating the world's consciousness. That's a business model? The We Company, commonly known as WeWork, has filed for an IPO which reportedly would value the company at $47 billion. WeWork tries to claim it's a tech company, but it's really a real estate company with low profit margins, if at all. The largest tenant in all of New York City, WeWork, with 5.2 million square feet of space, shelved its plan to go public this Monday, a week after ditching its controversial co-founder and CEO Adam Neumann. While most Wall Street savants think WeWork failed initial public offering was a harbinger of things to come in the IPO market, the truth is that the reason for the failure lies in WeWork's untested and fatally flawed business model. WeWork isn't just a tenant, it's also a landlord. It typically rents large spaces, then creates ultra-modern workspaces out of them to re-rent out on a short-term lease. It also owns some of the buildings in which it rents out spaces. The WeWork idea is great for startups, people who want to network, or even companies that wish to have a flexible presence in a city without having to manage a space or deal with long-term contracts. But too much of WeWork space is dedicated to communal areas, couches, cubbyholes, and chit-chat spots that do not generate revenue. And that's a problem in high-rent cities like New York, London, and Washington, D.C., where space is at a premium. WeWork can't make money even in this best of economic climate. For the first 6 months of 2019, the company lost almost $700 million on revenues of just $1.5 billion. So it's really no surprise that the IPO roadshow wasn't well received, especially considering Newman sold $750 million worth of stock leading up to it. This has affected its subsidiary, Meetup.com. Meetup.com is used by many, especially among computer club organizations, to get their meetings notice out to members. Meetup was founded in 2002 by CEO Scott Heiferman and four co-founders. The company was acquired by WeWork in 2017 and remains headquartered in New York City. How does Meetup.com work? Organizers set up groups, organize events, and develop event content. They also pay a fee starting at $16.49 a month to Meetup.com, under the expectation of sharing the costs with members that attend events. Meetup.com has policies against organizing meetups around a commercial interest, hate speech, or groups that do not meet in person. Meetup.com, a subsidiary of WeWork, has announced a significant change to its pricing structure that will require members to pay a $2 fee in order to RSVP to events. The change will go into effect immediately, ostensibly to distribute meetup costs more evenly between organizers and members. Some meetup organizers have received the following message. Meetup is always looking for ways to improve the experience for everyone in our community. One of the options we are currently exploring is whether we reduce costs for organizers and introduce a small fee for members. Beginning in October, members of select groups will be charged a small fee to reserve their spot at events. The event fee can be paid by members, or organizers can cover the cost of events to make it free to members. Organizers have the option to subsidize the $2 fee for members who RSVP, so that it is entirely free for those who attend. But for popular groups, this can become cost prohibitive. If 1,000 members RSVP for an event, the organizer would owe $2,000 to host it. And with many computer clubs with 50 to maybe 100 members, this is a sizable cost because all computer club meetings that we have announced are open to the public and there is no expense for attendance. The new pricing does not apply to nonprofit groups that are part of the official WordPress chapter. Meetup organizers and members who are affected by the pricing hike are unhappy about the changes. Many organizers have announced that they are canceling their subscriptions and looking to migrate to other platforms such as Community, that's Community with a K, or GetTogether.community, an open source alternative for managing local events. No competitor has reach or brand recognition that Meetup.com has, and some groups will inevitably resort to using Eventbrite or Facebook to manage local meetups. But neither of these are focused on promoting or growing these types of local events. The fact that Meetup.com is linked to WeWork is problematic for the long-term viability of Meetup.com to operate. Microsoft Word users are unhappy with Apple's new Catalina operating system. Apple released its new operating system, Catalina, for the desktop Mac, and users who have upgraded have had to make a few adjustments. The revamped operating system introduces a host of features such as the Apple Arcade game streaming service and revamped podcast, TV, and music apps. However, users are reporting an unwelcome surprise. Microsoft Word 2011 isn't compatible with Catalina. Installing Catalina is a sweeping upgrade because the new operating system will no longer support apps designed to run on the 32-bit processors that most computers had in the 1990s and the early 2000s. In basic terms, 32-bit processors are able to access 4 gigabytes of memory to run the calculations needed to complete a task. The amount of memory a processor can access impacts the system's speed. Apple began using 64-bit processors, which can theoretically access 16 EIB of memory, in the early 2000s and been trying to phase out 32-bit apps for the last 10 years. Mac operating systems have been 64-bit since the release of Snow Leopard in 2009. When Apple released High Sierra in 2017, the company started alerting users that it would soon end support for 32-bit apps with pop-up messages. With the release of Catalina, Apple is now forcing any straggling users to finally switch over to using 64-bit apps. Those who have been clinging on to 32-bit Microsoft Word 2011 are now out of luck, and they have to purchase Microsoft Word 2016 or Microsoft Word 2019. There are also a number of other 32-bit apps that people won't be able to use either, like older versions of Photoshop or Excel. Yet users seem particularly incensed about Word, perhaps because for many of us, it is so integral to daily life. Before you upgrade to Catalina, you should check to see whether there are any 32-bit apps on your system. To do this, click on the Apple icon on the upper left corner of your screen and select About This Mac from the drop-down menu. Once you see the system information window, click on System Report, then find Legacy Software on the menu to the left, and you'll see a list of your 32-bit apps. If you want to keep using those apps, it might be worth finding newer 64-bit versions. In some cases, as with Word, you have to buy the updated product. However, newer versions may also be free on the manufacturer's website, or you can just find alternatives. For example, you might find Google Docs to be an adequate substitute for Word. If you, for some reason, need to keep using 32-bit apps, you can purchase software that will allow you to continue using older Mac operating systems alongside Catalina. Look at Parallels Desktop and VMware Fusion, which are programs that allow users to set up a window that essentially serves as a parallel desktop. You can install previous Mac or even Windows operating systems on that second desktop to run 32-bit apps. You probably wouldn't want to go through all this trouble just to keep using Microsoft Word 2011, but it's a viable workaround if you really insist. Google announces new hardware. Google unveiled several new pieces of hardware yesterday. Brand new Pixelbooks. We used to call them Chromebooks. The next generation Nest Mini, Nest Wi-Fi, and the much-hyped Pixel 4 smartphone. The Google Pixel 4 picks up where the Pixel 3 left off. The Pixel 4 features an improved rear camera setup that now has two lenses, a 12-megapixel dual-pixel lens and a 16-megapixel telephoto lens. Now in terms of size, the Pixel 4 is available in both standard and XL variants. The standard Pixel 4 is equipped with a 5.7-inch display, while the XL gives you a 6.3-inch of screen real estate. Both displays are OLEDs. However, the XL has slightly better resolution, QHD Plus versus FHD Plus. The big news about both displays is that each will have a refresh rate of about 90 Hz. This is a feature that very few smartphones have and means that everything on the Pixel 4 screen will look incredibly smooth. Google appropriately titled this feature Smooth Display. Other flagship specs for both models include Qualcomm's latest processor, the Snapdragon 855, 6 gigabytes of RAM with 64 gigabytes or 128 gigabytes of memory, and the latest stock Android software. It's also worth noting the Pixel 4 XL comes with a larger battery, 3700 milliamp hours versus 2800 milliamp hours, to handle the additional heft. Another big announcement was a second-generation Nest Mini, rebranded in light of Google's recent acquisition of the Nest company. The Nest Mini is the direct follow-up to Google's popular Home Mini smart speaker. Despite the rebranding, the Nest Mini retains all of the beloved features of the Home Mini with some new upgrades. With that in mind, Google gave the Nest Mini more power than its predecessor, so users will enjoy an improved listening experience. Other improved features include the Nest Mini's ability to interface with thousands of compatible smart devices. Using just your voice, you can tell the Nest Mini to dim the lights, pause the TV, change your thermostat settings, and many other functions. Google also showed off the new Nest Wi-Fi, similar to the Nest Mini. Nest Wi-Fi is the rebranded next-generation Google Wi-Fi. Like Google Wi-Fi, Nest Wi-Fi is a scalable wireless network that blankets your home with fast, reliable Wi-Fi. Nest Wi-Fi has two core components, a router and a pointer. The router covers up to 2,200 square feet of your home, while each point adds an additional 1,600 square feet of Wi-Fi coverage. The two components work together, but they also are compatible with the previous generation of Google Wi-Fi. Additionally, each Nest Wi-Fi Nest Point has an integrated speaker with Google Assistant built in, so you can interact with your compatible devices using voice commands. Finally, Google also announced a long-awaited update to its Pixelbook series. The 2019 Pixelbook has a 13.3-inch touchscreen with up to 4K UHD resolution, a significant bump from the original Pixelbook 12.3-inch 2K display. Internal specs include an 8th-generation Intel Core processor with up to 16 gig of RAM and 256 gigabytes of storage. And because it's a Chromebook, the 2019 Pixelbook offers full Android app support. The iPhone 11 series is not scratch resistant. The iPhone 11 series was released last month, and the iPhone 11 starts at, well, just slightly under $700, which is $100 lower than the 2018's iPhone's XR starting price. Even in China and India, the latest iPhone series, they're selling well. So far, Apple's 2019 iPhones have been perfect. However, the first set of complaints are now hitting the web. With the increasing number of users of the iPhone 11 series, issues with the iPhones have begun to emerge. According to users' feedback, the iPhone 11 series is not scratch resistant. This is quite different from Apple's claim that this series used the most sturdy glass. Well, using the most sturdy glass doesn't mean that it's not scratch resistant, it's just sturdier. From reports, after using the iPhone for a short period, the display can scratch. The issue is not unique to the iPhone 11 Pro alone. It is consistent with the entire series. According to some users, even when the phone is placed in a separate pocket without other objects like keys, it still comes out with scratches. Therefore, for such an expensive phone, the best protection for daily use is to put it into a protective film as well as a phone case. It would be rather upsetting to spend over $500 on a phone and still be given conditions on how to handle it. Multiple problems reported with new Windows 10 updates. Two recent Windows 10 updates are breaking up boot ups, printing, the start menu, Windows Search, and VMware Workstation. The printing issues appear to be from KB4522016. While the start menu bug warns users, your start menu isn't working. The boot issue, however, is more concerning. Meanwhile, Windows KB 4517211, which is an optional cumulative Windows 10 update, is behind problems with Windows Search and Cortana. As for the VMware issues, Windows' latest reports impacted PCs are hit with the message, VMware Workstation Pro can't run on Windows. Check for an updated version of this app that runs on Windows. But no updated version exists. The good news is users have found that uninstalling both updates will fix these problems. And this is just the beginning that's being borne out in the last month alone. You can add these five new bugs into a list of Windows 10 updates, which have already broken search and the start menu, cause USB and audio problems, screen discoloration, and spiked CPU usage and disconnected users from the internet. With Microsoft also continuing to push its Windows 10 build 19.03, make sure your restore points options are on so you can uninstall these updates. Now Microsoft is taking control over your personal computer. Microsoft rolled out Windows Virtual Desktop, called WVD. If you have a fast internet connection to an Azure region, you can run your desktop off the Azure today. Maybe you're okay with running on cloud based on Windows. Hell, I'm not. I want to be in charge of my desktop. And I can paint some pretty scary scenarios why you should as well. Just an example. Suppose the United States government decides you can't use software from a US-based cloud. If you had Windows on a desktop, you just keep going. But if it's a cloud service, you're dead in the water. That's not a made-up example. Adobe is shutting down its application service for Venezuelan users to comply with a U.S. executive order that prohibits trade with that country. If you live in Caracas, you soon won't be able to use Acrobat, InDesign, Illustrator, Photoshop, or Premiere. The exact same thing could happen if you relied on Azure for your desktop. That said, let's take a closer look at WVD. First, the good parts. The WVD client app is available, and as of now, just not on Windows, but also on Android, Mac, iOS, and HTML6. The last means that you can run Windows on most popular desktop browsers. Specifically, you can run WVD on Chrome Edge, Firefox, Internet Explorer, or now called Edge, and Safari. Moreover, Microsoft says, well, brace yourself for this, you can run WVD on Chrome OS, Mac OS, as well as Linux. They say this is the real Windows, and Microsoft said companies want to move this to the cloud, and WVD is really the only way to run real Windows 10 clients, multi-user in the public cloud. Microsoft, which has also made no bones about wanting you to move to Office 365 instead of upgrading to Office 2019, has also optimized it for use with its business-oriented Office 365 Pro Plus. Another interesting thing about this change is Microsoft doesn't care anymore if you use desktop Windows. The old argument against non-Windows alternatives ran something like this. Oh, I could never use a Mac, Linux, or Chromebook, or whatever, because it doesn't run my favorite Windows-only program. Did you hear what I just said earlier? You can run your Windows apps via WVD on a Chrome OS, Linux, or a Mac OS now. With WVD, Microsoft doesn't care if you run Windows on your PC anymore, Chromebook, Mac, or Linux PC. It's all good now. Microsoft will still get paid. You still have your Windows apps, but the PC, as a standalone platform, it's on the way out. And those are the pros. And the cons? Well, in its latest updates, Microsoft has made it much harder to create an Office local account. You know, the one with just a username and password that you've been using since Windows 1.0 came into production back in 1985. Microsoft started making it harder to use a local PC-based account with the October 2018 update. It relented a little bit with the May 2019 release, but now it is more complex to set up a local Windows account. It's still there, but if you're connected to the internet, Microsoft wants you to log into Windows with a cloud-based ID and password. Like it or not, Microsoft wants you to give up your standalone PC operating system for a centralized cloud-based operating system. Microsoft is moving consumers to Windows as a service. This is not a good thing. Ultimately, I want computing power to be in my hands, not Microsoft or any other companies, or for that matter, the federal government. If you go along with this, as any poor soul working in Venezuela with Adobe products can tell you, you're asking for misery. The latest in TV subscription deals. You may have caught word a couple months back of a limited time, 3-year discounted Disney Plus subscription that shook out to be about, $4 per month. If that wasn't enough to turn the heads of some wayward Netflix subscribers, maybe a second chance to score the streaming service at a deep discount ahead of its official launch will do the trick. The Disney Plus deal, which is a 3-year subscription, is just under $5 per month for most of what Disney Plus has to offer, including Pixar, past Disney films, Star Wars, National Geographic, every season of The Simpsons, Marvel films, well, and a bunch of originals. It's worth noting that this offer doesn't include Hulu and ESPN Plus, which will be included in the Disney Plus bundle of $13 when the service launches in November. That Disney is baiting subscribers with discounts for an already inexpensive service jam-packed with content at launch does not bode particularly well for Netflix, which reported in July that it was losing customers for the first time in years. Currently, Netflix costs $9 a month for a basic plan that's no HD streaming and one screen streaming, $13 for a standard plan, HD streaming and two screens, and $16 for its premium plan, HD and Ultra HD streaming on up to four screens at once. Compared to Disney Plus at launch, Disney is more expensive, even for its most basic tier. But price isn't the only way Disney Plus is attempting to lure viewers to its streaming service. Disney revealed that its service would come standard with 4K, UHD, and high dynamic range streaming, as well as allow for simultaneous streaming on up to four devices. Features that Netflix subscribers must cough up an additional $3 to $7 to unlock. While Disney Plus will offer premium films and series from beloved franchises, in addition to new and original content, Netflix has focused primarily on quantity over quality. So certainly on the pricing and quality front, Disney already has an upper hand in its offerings. But if that weren't enough, it's also taking a shot at Netflix outside of the streaming space. According to a report from the Wall Street Journal, Disney is banning Netflix ads on many of its TV channels and networks, and with the exception of ESPN, which probably isn't great news for a streaming service now faced with Disney and Apple promising high-quality content rather than reruns of old series and mid-tier originals. The beauty of services is that you can pick and choose which ones you find most appealing and skip the ones you don't. And while subscribing to more than one is perfectly fine, there's an argument to be made that there is such a thing as too many services. Many will opt out of some streaming subscriptions they no longer regularly use as newer, shinier services enter the streaming scene. Of course, Disney could always raise the price of its service after it seduced subscribers into its grasp. The streaming service won't cost $7 forever. It's 3 years, $5 per month. Subscription promotion seems like a good way to secure a low rate on a streaming service that's great right out of the gate. I might even think about it. In our feature segment by Benjamin Rockwell, IT Pro Series, BYOD Bring Your Own Devices to Work, Part 3 of 3.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now we're going to get down to business. Yeah, this is the time where I give you tidbits from my past, from my experience of being an IT professional since the early 90s. And I will tell you, it's been an enjoyable ride all the way along. Over the years, I have dealt with a number of different variations of BYOD. This is the last in a three-part series on Bring Your Own Device. Now, over the course of my past, we have had situations where BYOD meant you brought your own computer from home, or you bought a computer and you brought it into the office, and then the techs in the office would support whatever you had to make sure it got onto the network and that you could utilize any of the programs that were there. Then, in a particular evolution, we went to, yes, some of the different people up in the corporate hierarchy said, I'm not going to use what the company wants. I'm going to use my own thing because I like my own thing. And you're going to support it. So we did. And that was quite exciting. And then we've moved on to a sort of a standardization. We're going to support these different items. You go on out, you buy them. Or we, as a company, we might buy them for you and say, look, here's a smartphone. It does happen to be an iPhone 10. It's got all of the different software you're going to need. You can use it for making your own text messages, phone calls, and all of and your own email. Put all that on there as well if you like. But for the most part, it's our phone. We'll pay for the rest, which is great. All right. So there are BYOD problems that we still have yet to address. These are different things that still will continue as we mature in our treatment of BYOD as IT professionals. One of the biggest things, I think, all the way along is the very first one that I dealt with years ago. It is the idea of supporting anything and everything. The idea that you can bring in your BlackBerry phone. Yes, BlackBerry still does make a phone, I think. They might have made their last one in the last 6 months, although we've been hearing about the demise of BlackBerry for a very long time. Anyways, another story for another day. So, the idea that we would support everything on every different level that it might be. Android operating system, for instance, many phones out there, brand new phones, are using really outdated software. Some of them are using the latest and greatest and supporting different network issues gets to be a little bit difficult with that. I do suggest if you're going to BYOD, if you're going to bring your own device into the office, be prepared to actually support it yourself. Know your smartphone and work with the IT folks the best you can and say, could it be this? Could it be that? And team with them, partner with them instead of throwing it at them and saying, here, you fix it. And not that I'm saying that you would. I just have heard of people who do that. And I want to encourage you not to do that. The various idea of BYOD policies has come up over the years. And these different policies will regulate what you can use your device for and what you can't use your device for. Some of the issues that we've seen over the years are people will take their smartphone and they're sitting at home and they're copying all kinds of data off of the network to their home system or sharing it with other places. And that's kind of a scary thing. And we, as IT professionals, we've got to hop on that. We've got to keep aware of all of the different problems that can come along. This becomes a very dangerous situation where we're talking about insider data loss and data breaches of sorts because the information's moving off. It's not a true data breach because somebody may already have that, full access to that information. So one of the other things that also comes along, not so much on the iOS devices, but on the Android devices, mobile devices can carry malware. Your various smartphones and tablets, if they're not iOS, do carry malware. There's only been, I think, just a couple of malware items in the iOS realm, and most of it was proof of concept versus anything else. So one of the policies that I strongly support and has recently come to the forefront is that if a mobile device has access to the various computing systems of the corporation, the corporation's IT team needs to be able to control it. They need to be able to wipe it via remote. They need to be able to take action against a stolen phone, against a lost phone, against somebody who left the company and still has that phone. I've actually had to take part in that. I've had many different conversations over the years with a few different people who left the company. Oh, we're going to let Johnny have this phone as he leaves. You're going to do what? We have company secrets on that phone. You can't do that. So then we go back, we wipe it. And I've run into that a few different ways, a few different times. It's okay, though. We're going to see that they're going to have control. A lot of the control used to be very simple. We press a button, and the phone doesn't blow up. It doesn't have smoke coming out of it like Mission Impossible. This phone will self-destruct in 10 seconds. Good luck, Jim. It does selectively wipe very certain information. We know that the email is company email. Wiped, gone. We know that certain attachments are company attachments. Wiped, gone. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that we need to still plan on, we still need to work with. And, yeah, there is that possibility that we could completely electronically nuke the phone via remote. Yes. Ah, well, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. What is Libra cryptocurrency and Calibra wallet? Blockchain, cryptocurrency, and Bitcoin were the buzzwords just a few years ago. Many people who invested in this lost their hard-earned money in this venture. However, one good thing still came out of it. Blockchain is a secure system for creating decentralized currency. 5 months ago, on June the 18th of this year, Facebook launched its own cryptocurrency, and it is called Libra. Mark Zuckerberg plans to develop this new currency and to make it an actual viable option for payment. The project mission is to implement a simple global currency and financial infrastructure that empowers billions of people. In addition to Libra, Facebook is also going to launch a dedicated wallet app called Calibra. This currency would be exchanged via Messenger, WhatsApp, and Calibra's own dedicated mobile app. Of course, this is all from Facebook. The main incentive behind this initiative is to make global payments fast and painless. Moreover, countless people will get their own accounts for the first time, even if it's a virtual one. All anyone's got to do is buy Libra coins using real money. You can buy it using any currency around the globe. The exchange rates, however, are going to vary. Facebook gathered many financial institutions in this monetary venture. So what has happened in 5 months since Facebook announced this? Facebook is losing traction on this launch. Facebook cryptocurrency project suffers massive blows as MasterCard, Visa, eBay, and others withdraw from Libra. MasterCard, Visa, eBay, Mercado Pago, Booking Holdings, and Stripe are exiting Facebook's planned cryptocurrency project Libra. PayPal also dropped out of talks to work with Facebook on Libra in recent weeks. Facebook's deteriorating relationships with Libra partners combined with intense scrutiny from lawmakers leave the future of the initiative uncertain. Mark Zuckerberg will be appearing before Congress next week in a hearing where they want to know more about cryptocurrency and what the risks are. Facebook thanked Visa and MasterCard for sticking it out until the 11th hour and cautioned against reading the fate of Libra into this update. The future of Facebook's cryptocurrency project is in jeopardy as many of the companies initially attached to Libra have jumped ship. MasterCard, Visa, eBay, Stripe, and Mercado Pago will all no longer participate in the Libra Association. PayPal, on October 4th, was the first major partner to withdraw from the organization. The exits, combined with the intense scrutiny from lawmakers, represents a huge blow to the initiative and leaves its future uncertain. Former PayPal president David Marcus is the chief executive behind the Libra initiative, and he tweeted out thanks to MasterCard and Visa for sticking with the project as long as they did. Marcus made the following statement. We highly respect the vision of the Libra Association. However, eBay has made the decision to not move forward as a founding member. At this time, we are focused on rolling out eBay's managed payments experience for our customers. An eBay spokesperson said they highly respect the vision of Libra Association. However, eBay has made the decision to not move forward as a founding member. At this time, we are focused on rolling out eBay's managed payments experience for our customers. A spokesperson for Visa said that they had decided not to join the Libra Association at this time. We will continue to evaluate, and our ultimate decision will be determined by a number of factors, including the association's ability to fully satisfy all requisite regulatory expectations. Visa's continued interest in Libra stems from our belief that well-regulated blockchain-based networks could extend the value of secure digital payments to a greater number of people and places, particularly in emerging and developing markets. In a separate statement, Stripe said it would consider rejoining the association in the future. Stripe is supportive of the projects that aim to make online commerce more accessible for people around the world. We will follow its progress closely and remain open to working with the Libra Association at a later stage. Lawmakers urged MasterCard and Visa to withdraw from the Libra Association after a recent report from the Wall Street Journal said both companies were reluctant to offer public support for Facebook's cryptocurrency. Facebook announced its plans for Libra in June and said it would work to satisfy the concerns of regulators in the United States and abroad before launching. Facebook blockchain boss David Marcus says Libra won't launch until it has fully addressed regulatory concerns. Marcus tried to assuage the concerns from U.S. lawmakers during an extended Senate hearing in July. U.S. lawmakers expressed concerns over Facebook's ability to keep Libra secure and questioned whether a well-funded cryptocurrency would give the social media giant too much market power. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg will testify before the House Financial Services Committee on October the 23rd, where he is likely to face more tough questions regarding Libra. Feature segment with Marty Winston on Technology Perspectives, Trick or Treating with Tech.
Okay, I think I'm ready. I want to get into some ideas for trick or treating with tech. In fact, with a few separate interpretations of that topic. So, if you're not afraid to keep listening, let's get into it. I'll start with some tech tricks with which you can amaze your visitors, then spend a little time talking about tech you might consider for protecting yourself from the tricks. Then I want to get into a couple of ways that tech can be a treat. Ready? There was a time when all you had to do was to turn on the front lights and stick a candle in a carved-out pumpkin, and you were ready for your visitors at the door. These days, instead of a candle, get a battery-operated, LED-illuminated, flickering tea light candle. It might be a better idea, just to avoid having a flame up there. And an artificial jack-o'-lantern pumpkin is recyclable, meaning you can use it again next year. And you're much less likely to find it a smashed mess in a cleanup chore the next morning. But listen, as long as you don't run out of treats, nobody cares how much or how little you decorate. What's that? Oh, yeah, I forgot. You care. And you want some tech ideas for putting on a front yard Halloween show that's worthy of Orlando or Anaheim. I don't have to tell you, that stores galore have things you can buy to do that, off the shelf. From simple to complicated. With motion, with sound effects, with lighting effects, with smoke. And they have triggers that are designed to startle and surprise your visitors. Hey, it's your retirement fund, and if you want to spend it on a single day's stagecraft, I hope you really enjoy it. But maybe you want to do something that's not at fine stores everywhere. So here are some ideas for that. Do you own a projector? If you put a translucent sheet inside your storm door, there are hundreds of things you can record on video and rear project there that can spook your visitors. Start with an image of what they expect to see, your door. Then use your video editing skills. You can make it disappear in a flash and a puff of smoke. You can make it look like it's on fire. It can look like ghosts or skeletons are trying to ooze their way through. Or like it's turning into a giant mouth with fangs. Or like a corpse in a noose just dropped into the doorway from above. Or as if, beyond it, inside the house, everyone's gathered at a table fairly well back in the room. They're all munching on bones, and just in front of the table, a steaming cauldron holds children in Halloween costumes. Spooky, huh? And all of that is just rear projection. You can also put some modest intensity ultraviolet lamps above the doorway. Then you can dress up in makeup that glows in the dark. If you're artistic, you may even figure a way to change from a normal friendly face to something more horrific. Of course, if you're starting with a horrific face, skip that. Just show up. I'll bet that fake pumpkin and LED tea light are starting to sound a little more interesting right now, aren't they, huh? So much for your decor. What about the costumed thugs who use Halloween as an excuse for damage, destruction, defacement, delinquency, devastation? One thing you might consider is to see how inexpensive it might be to temporarily lower the deductible on your homeowner's insurance. But there are some more active defenses you can consider. Lighting comes first to mind. You can replace the outdoor lights with brighter LED lights that include motion activation. Naughty kids hate to be seen, and light makes them a lot more visible. You could also find some way to get under the eaves and mount a small surveillance camera and set it to motion trigger. Read through the bullet points when you shop for those. There are only a few that run on just batteries. Many expect an ongoing power source, often from a USB adapter. And of course, you can find USB rechargeable power banks, battery banks, that should be good for a night. You're putting this under the eaves to keep it out of easy reach, but what I'm describing is temporary. So make sure to take it down the next day. If nothing happened, no big deal. But if something did, an SD card in the camera or the app's cloud video can help identify who done it. Only don't count on too much when it's time to identify that costumed culprit. Remember, it's the one night each year when costumes and disguises are the norm. One more note on defenses, this time indoors. When your own kids get back with their bags of booty, prepare yourself with a flashlight, a magnifying glass, and a metal detector. Even an electronic stud finder can work. Take a close look at everything in the bag. Look for holes or splits in wrappers. Look for consumables that are not fully packaged. Look for labels that might have been counterfeited on somebody's personal printer. And use that stud finder or metal detector to scan for metal inside the food. After you've checked everything, ask each child which one treat they'd like to have first. Let them open its wrapper. Let them put it on a cutting board, and then you slice it. Let the child participate with the flashlight and magnifying glass and inspect those pieces. Now, that last part is a teaching exercise in caution when accepting gifts from people who aren't family. One more stop before we finish. The theme is overall about trick or treating with tech, and everything so far has been mostly about the tricks. What about tech as the treat? How uncanny. It's uncandy. The idea of passing out tech instead of sugary sweet treats. It doesn't have to be crazy expensive. Let's put that into context. How many kids call on your house? I did a little online homework, looking up the pricing on multi-packs of some modestly priced tech products. You may find better prices anywhere, but just for reference, here's some of what I saw on Amazon. A pack of 10 mini flashlights for $8.50. Or 18 pocket flashlights for $25. Or 48 working toy flashlights for $18. Or 50 keychain lights for $23. They also have those stick-on grab rings for smartphones to help keep them from slipping out of your hands. Those are in a kit of 10 for $5. Or they have 48 glow-in-the-dark bouncy balls for $6.50. A pack of 40 colorful LED finger lights is at $8. One more idea. And of course, you'll like these better if they don't go to your own kids. Well, maybe. A local store offers inexpensive party packs of whistles or other eventually annoying noisemakers. The point is, the thing you give doesn't have to be candy. That's the trick with treats. Next time, having nothing at all to do with Halloween, I'll take a look at tool tricks and tool treats. I see a lot of really cool tools, and I've been coming across a lot of advice about clever other uses for them, too. So next time, join me for tool tricks and treats. Costumes optional.
Thank you, Marty. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Tri-State region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open, free to the public. Princeton PC Users Group will have a presentation, Protecting Your Digital Life, October the 22nd. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on the most common PC and Mac repair issues. They meet on October the 24th, the fourth Thursday, and the meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their meeting on November the 1st, the first Friday of the month of November. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 on 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have their meeting on the first Tuesday, November the 5th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they meet at the Danbury Hackerspace, located at 158 Main Street, Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC Users Group meets on the first Thursday of Monday, that's November the 7th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet in the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, White Plains, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting on the second Friday, November the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus out in Old Westbury, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets the second Thursday of each month, and they meet November the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and their meeting locations at NYU Silver Building, 32 Waverly Place, and check at the front desk for the room number. And that's all in Manhattan, New York. We hope to see you at one of these meetings. If you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.